You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. Today is the 29th of December, 2021. I'm guaranteeing you that 2022 is going to be a very interesting year for a lot of people. Talk about that a bit more next week. But this is my last broadcast of 2021. It has been an extremely difficult year for those on the right, even for the moderate, losery conservative types, who are just as censured as we are. And suddenly they've come to realize that censorship isn't a good thing. The matter isn't so much the First Amendment. There's no abstraction to appeal to. It's that it's true. Truth is the only justification for any kind of political speech, not some abstraction. But abstractions don't convince anyone. I thank you for the, my donors have been generous. Those who have been joining my, Patreon page, I encourage that. And you can see that at the Radio, Albion site, my own website too. And I apologize, I've not been keeping up with my website updates. That's going to change in the new year. And in this new year, too, I'm going to be working on different projects and different platforms to build my presence in addition to what I'm doing right now, and see how much we can get away with YouTube or a Telegram. And of course, I need your assistance, as always, with these things, because none of this stuff comes cheap. But today I'm asking the question, given what happened in Afghanistan, something that I predicted in 2018. I published an article saying that that war had already been lost, and I began to speculate on what the withdrawal propaganda is going to be. It was more ham-handed than I expected. But where the U.S. military is concerned, being ham-handed is par for the course. So I want to talk about Afghanistan today. In particular, I want to talk about the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. And I'm not 100% certain that the Soviets lost that war. They withdrew when they thought that the local government was strong enough to maintain itself. And it did for many years afterwards. Boris Gromov, the commander of the 40th Army, I'm going to rely on him a bit later on to give the basic outline of the argument that the Soviets did not lose. And they certainly weren't humiliated as the U.S. was humiliated. Now, most of you know Soviet interest in Afghanistan goes back to the very beginning. And Afghanistan has always been coveted for its minerals, for its oil and gas. Soviet geologists were all over Afghanistan. Same thing for the Soviet republics in Central Asia. They were searching for oil and gas. They only found gas. But Afghanistan, the Afghan government had traditionally been dependent on the USSR. And part of this dependency were their purchases of gasoline, diesel fuel, engine oil, rubber, these kind of things. But fuel was the big moneymaker. So Soviet geologists were looking for oil and gas to rebuild the country's economy. Gas was found, oil was not. In fact, they even began to supply gas to the Soviet Union with three lines through the Amu Darya, but the supply was unstable. These supplies were needed in the southern Soviet republics, but they also served as part of the repayment of loans, given Afghan's dependency on the USSR. But because of the Soviet presence there, in this case unofficial, you did have groups converting to Marxism, those who were disaffected from Islam for whatever reason. You even had these in the military. In 1965, what will soon be the ruling party, the People's Democratic Party of Afghanistan, was formed, which was the pro-Soviet platform. And N.M. Taraki was elected the General Secretary, and Karmal, Secretary of the Central Committee, so it was organized on Soviet lines. But parties like this don't last in a divided country. So they had the Kalk movement, which was led by Taraki and was supportive of the Soviet Union. And the other one, the Parcham movement, led by Karmal. Still, it gained a certain amount of influence within the intelligentsia of the country and had substantial adherence within the officer corps. But at the time when this developed, Afghanistan still had a monarch, Zahir Shah. In 1973, as he was visiting Italy, there was a coup that took place, and power was seized by his one of his relatives, Mohammad Daoud, who proclaimed the First Republic of Afghanistan. And he said right away, his press conferences, he talked about being freed from the royal regime, carrying out land reform, and guaranteeing the rights and freedoms of the population. Typical politician talk. And he wanted to ease international tension to become a part of the non-aligned movement. He refused to give any credit to the PDPA, the People's Democratic Party of Afghanistan, and he claims that really it was the army, Republican forces in the army, that took over. But his policies ended in failure. This is normally the case with republics in an unruly country. It was extremely unstable, and the rivalry not only among communist groups, but the hatred of the Islamic movement for communism. And the Islamic movement provoked numerous uprisings, but all of them were suppressed at greater and greater cost. But Daoud was, his reign was ended with the Saur Revolution in April of 1978, and the viciousness with which he was executed and members of his family. But as this was going on, the Soviets built roads and linked the most important economic regions of the country. They provided military assistance to Afghanistan, especially in the equipment for the armed forces. Natural gas production saw substantial investments, many large projects, Nagulu power plant, the massive dam, the Jalalabad complex, which was mass irrigation, and roadways and connectivity were the creation of a unified country for the first time. Bridges, roadways, this was a Soviet investment in the country. Not to mention, of course, the provision of loans, and to a great extent, these projects, despite being financed by the USSR, were to create the means of paying this money back. Afghanistan didn't really have specialists in this area. You had a mostly unskilled labor force, and so the USSR built the Polytechnic Institute and a machine building and a technical school in Kabul. So many of the institutions that function in the country up until the war were of Soviet construct. But the Saur Revolution, they call the April Revolution, that brought the PDPA into power and the proclamation of the Democratic Republic of Afghanistan. And the main goal of this movement, this was a movement that's going to appeal to the Soviet Union for intervention, was any of its agenda was meant to force through reform, including an attack, direct attack on Islam. And so many of the projects the Soviets were financing there were damaged by the Islamic opposition. But even in before April 1978, a civil war broke out. You had mutinies even within the army. And the viciousness of the PDPA coup meant that someone of a red terror had descended on the cities, largely against the Islamic population. And this was the Khalq movement. And the Parcham, led by Karmal, came under attack. And those were the two targets of the Red Terror at the time. But the initially, there were about 20 total requests for direct Soviet intervention. And the PDPA even began to purge its own officer corps, leading to tremendous dissatisfaction and a loss of morale. The CPSU at that time was opposed to intervention. There was at least 20 requests, but there were some, like Gromyko, who was Minister of Foreign Affairs, said the following. I'm going to quote him directly here. "The question is, what will we win? Afghanistan with its current government, with a backward economy, with little weight in international affairs. On the other hand, we have to bear in mind that we can't legally justify the introduction of troops. According to the UN Charter, a country can ask for help, and we can send troops in case they were subjected to aggression from outside. Afghanistan was not subject to any aggression. That's their internal affair, revolutionary civil strife, battles between one group of the population against another. In addition, it has to be said that the Afghans didn't officially contact us regarding the deployment of troops. In a word, we're dealing here with such a case when the country's leadership, as a result of its own serious mistakes, was not up to the task and didn't enjoy the proper support of the people. If we, for example, take the risk, the introduction of troops, then of course, you'll get far fewer pluses than minuses. We still don't know how the Afghan army will behave. And if she does not support our event or remains neutral, then it turns out we are occupying Afghanistan with our own men. By this, we will create for ourselves an incredibly difficult situation in foreign policy." So, in the spring of 79, the Soviet leadership were, well, they adequately assessed the consequences of any possible entry of Soviet troops into Afghanistan. But further developments in the situation, the armed demonstrations of the Islamic opposition, mutinies in the army, internal party struggles, and most importantly, in September of 79, when Taraki, the leader of the PDPA, was arrested and killed on the orders of Hafizullah Amin, removing him from power, is one of the things that caused serious concern amongst the Soviet leadership. Amin was not popular in Soviet ruling classes. They were very careful in observing him. His ambition, his brutality, his ability to use violence for strictly personal goals. But Amin, the terror increased, not only against the Muslim movement, but against Taraki supporters. Now you have the opposite violence, and that party itself was becoming decimated. The repressions affected the army yet again, which was the main support for the PDPA, which led to the diminution of its already low morale. And as became something normal for the Afghan army, it caused mass desertions and even local revolts. That began to change Brezhnev's point of view in the matter. They were worried that the exacerbation of the situation would lead to the fall of the PDPA regime and the coming to power of Islamists or others hostile to the USSR. Then the KGB received information about Amin's connections with the CIA and secret contacts of its emissaries with U.S. officials after the assassination of Taraki. The CIA may have had something to do with the seizure of power by Amin and his eventual murder of Taraki, which shocked the Soviet leaders. But Taraki had been the favorite of the Soviet ruling classes, and Brezhnev fully trusted him. And so his execution and then persecution of his followers led to also killings, and several of these revolts, by the way, killed Soviet citizens. So it was decided at that point to overthrow Amin and replace him with a leader, Mordechai, and they chose Brabak Karmal. And the head of the KGB, who soon became dictator, Andropov, supported that. So it didn't take long before the introduction of men, armed troops into Afghanistan was seen as a necessity. The U.S. was already heavily involved in the country, and a lot of people don't know this, but Communist China was a huge support of the Mujahideen movement there. The U.S. and the Chinese were working together for its building tactical observation posts in the southern border of the USSR, knowing full well that the fall of the PDPA would lead to a anti-Soviet state with heavy both Chinese and American presence. Now, the entry of Soviet troops to Afghanistan was well planned and prepared. The difficulties were in manning the formation with assigned personnel and equipment. There was a Turkmenistan division of the Turks in that area in the spring of 79, trying to create a Islamic corps, also mobilizing reserve servicemen. But despite the difficult climatic conditions in the winter, the entry took place without incident. And the initial engagements with the Soviet army led to very low casualties. Apparently, the Afghan army saw the introduction of Soviet troops in a favorable way. Much of the population also saw this temporary invasion as in a favorable way, as a way to continue, because they benefited clearly from the Soviet intervention in the economic realm. But of course, the hardcore Muslim movement would be satisfied only with domination of the country. So the battalion of the 186th Mechanized Infantry Division suppressed the rebellion of the Afghan Artillery Regiment and only lost two people. That was the very first engagement of the war. The Minister of Defense was Ustinov, and began planning raids against rebel groups in northern regions, those closest to the Soviet border. And there was a prohibition of airstrikes in populated areas, even if they're occupied by rebels. But the Mujahideen were building gradually a system of small supply points and strong points. Operational combat outputs in daily combat activities, which brought greater results with even less effort. They carefully planned large operations with the involvement of many people and equipment, and they were well supplied from the Chinese via Pakistan, as well as the Pakistanis themselves. So there was a group of officers in the USSR Ministry of Defense, and one of their works on the Afghan War, they divided up the presence of the Soviet Union there in four stages. The first, from December of 79, February of 1980, the introduction of Soviet troops into Afghanistan and the building of garrisons. From 80 to 85, active hostilities, large-scale wars, large-scale offensives, and strengthening the armed forces of the DRA, the Democratic Republic of Afghanistan. 85 to 87, the transition of active operations mainly to the support of Afghan troops by Soviet aviation, artillery, and sapper units. Special forces continued to fight to prevent the delivery of weapons and ammunition from abroad, especially Pakistan. And this was when a partial withdrawal of Soviet troops from the territory of Afghanistan was carried out. This is something along the lines of Vietnamization under the Nixon administration. 87 to 89, the Soviet Army's participation in the National Reconciliation Movement, with continued support for combat activities of the Afghan army, and the preparation of Soviet troops' withdrawal, and their finally complete withdrawal. In the beginning of 1980, the presence of the Soviet army was largely established. The manpower personnel issues were taken care of. By March of 1980, you had 33,500 people had been replaced. So it was already one rotation of men. Cars and other equipment from the national economy were replaced with army models. Everything was changing here. The Muslim Battalion was formed February of 1980, and the more advanced anti-aircraft missile brigades and all these others were introduced shortly thereafter. The 40th Army was finally fully formed by April, and it consisted of four divisions. So at this point, you had 81,000 men in the Soviet Union, in the country. Soviet troops in the country had about 3,000 armored vehicles, 900 guns and mortars, and 200 aircraft, helicopters and fighter bombers. And the a directive from the Minister of Defense Ustinov on the planning and the start of raids against rebel groups in the northern regions. And use of heavy fire, including airstrikes, to suppress resistance so long as it's not in populated areas. When the opposition then tried to act openly, the Soviet troops seemed to win almost every battle. Early on, major victories in the north of the country. Largest operation using tanks near the full conventional war was carried out early on in the provinces of Parwan, Kunar, Herat, etc., in the coast district. And these were against the detachments of Ahmad Massoud, trying to control the Solang Path, which connected the north of the country with the south, with the capital of Kabul, also in the province of Kunar. So this is an extremely strategic area. Centers of revolts around cities were very quickly repressed. Large groups were defeated in the area, in Talukan, Takar, many other cities, and entire formations of Nuristan and Khazarajast were completely liquidated. So very early on, that first phase, or really the first two phases, it was nothing but Soviet victories. By the end of 1980, life in the cities returned to normal. That early, the Soviets were planning on just handing everything over to the army and the withdrawal. That was the plan. It would have been a very brief intervention. However, it was the Afghan leadership at the time which was a total and complete disaster. They continued to purge the army in their struggle for power. Any general or colonel that threatened them was removed. All hopes for stabilizing the situation then meant the presence of the Soviet army. This Afghan army was getting worse and worse and worse. And then, as this is going on, you had peace in the country after this initial invasion, but the communists in Afghanistan refused to take that seriously. They continued to use that peace just to destroy their domestic opponents within the party. But the Mujahideen were also changing at the same time. It switched from military operations, using large field forces in open areas where they had lost, badly, to sabotage actions in small groups. The tactics and strategy of the regular army, once this period was over, often was useless in a counter-guerrilla struggle. Not to mention you're dealing with mountainous and desert terrain, unusual for personnel, very, very difficult to use equipment. The Mujahideen acted in small armed detachments, very mobile, quickly withdrawing from the attack, typical guerrilla movements. So search and detection became the paramount task. Very different from traditional methods, and the best reconnaissance units that already existed were sent there. Part of the there were 38 reconnaissance companies in the 40th Army in this period. Adjustments were made to the organizational structure of divisions, too cumbersome and overloaded with unnecessary units. The battalion then became the main combat unit, the forces of which were sufficient to carry out most of the current tasks, given the fact that the Mujahideen were using small, very mobile groups. Platoons, companies, battalions, this characterized the combat work of motorized rifle and airborne troops. Combat units on duty, reinforced battalions, on duty in readiness for an immediate response to incoming data and strikes on the noticed detachments of the Mujahideen or Dushman. So the army attempted to create these very same mobile units. Army groups were widely used, but not in the standard structure that were quite practical for the time. Tanks and armored vehicles brought together under single command accompanied fighters in raids or had to come to the rescue in many cases. So information became essential for the army. Apparently there was this split between the army and the KGB. You saw this in Chechnya, where the interior ministry and the army were fighting one another. But you had an arsenal of military intelligence, everything from aerial photography to space reconnaissance to daily observation intelligence work. And at a more practical level, at a more political level, I should say, Central Committee of, this is the end of 1980, the CPSU, the Council of Ministers adopted a resolution on the development of work and creation and production of complexes of reconnaissance signal equipment, which sounds very cumbersome, but it provides for the deployment of systems, of high-tech systems that can listen to terrain and detect movement of the enemy in long distances. Instrumental intelligence had been revolutionized. And of course, the most valuable information was obtained firsthand from its information networks. But even that had to be treated with caution. So the monitoring process for the Soviet Army was very difficult. Grand total, you had 862 outposts deployed around key facilities, roads near bridges and passes. 184 of these outposts were located along communications, important roads. So taking into account remote posts, in a short time, it even surpassed 1,000 of these. Round-the-clock observation of the situation, also undercover work, and an established radio interception system gave a pretty good picture of what was happening. So the intelligence issue was solved. So as the Mujahideen were building a system of small supply points, strong points, operational combat outputs, daily activities brought greater revolts with less effort than previously assigned, as I mentioned. And they began planning large operations with the involvement of many people and equipment, but small operations were still their dominant method. Soviets were using flexible countermeasures, unplanned strikes, private operations. They called it intelligence-driven implementation. Very quick, without your normal command structure. But no matter what the Soviets did, no matter how many victories they won, no matter how they adapted, you saw a continued strengthening of the Mujahideen and the growth and activity of its movement. By this time, you had a sharp increase in funding from the United States. In addition to the U.S. and China, who have been working together in this respect, Pakistan, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and a few Western European countries took the most active part in providing assistance and support to the Mujahideen of various types. Winter of 1983, something changed again. The Dushman group of the Mujahideen, with the arrival of winter, because snow and cold made it difficult to function in the mountains, would disperse to the villages, giving themselves a rest. However, now, they had built a more permanent structure. They stopped leaving Afghanistan because they actually had an entire system of garrisons. The question is, where is this all coming from? Now, where did the Mujahideen go after their sorties? They received reinforcements, weapons, and ammunition. Their bases grew. They had warehouses, communication centers, weapons workshops. They had a cartridge plant in the Khost district. They had a huge system of transferring goods from storage facilities in Iran and Pakistan to transshipment bases and base areas had developed, and they spread already within Afghanistan itself. And this comes, of course, from foreign intelligence and foreign money. So by 83, the Afghan opposition had a pretty standard system of military training, which was largely in Pakistan and Iran, and what we call the caravan route, bringing in large numbers of weapons from neighboring Pakistan. They even had a reserve unit to compensate for losses. I think the Soviets made record of 212 specialized centers and training centers It was 178 in Pakistan and 34 in Iran, and they trained roughly 75,000 people in a year. The Mujahideen numbered anywhere from 150,000 to 300,000 at any given time. So you had caravans coming in from the border delivering weapons and equipment to the opposition, to the Mujahideen, and bombings and operations to capture them weren't effective. No different than the Ho Chi Minh Trail in Vietnam. This reserve system and equipment, caravan system had to be destroyed. So the most tangible results yielded by preventative actions to block caravan routes, which was extremely complex given the size of that border. The anti-caravan movement, we'll talk about the code name Vail, Operation Vail, which provided a number of measures to block caravan routes and deprive these groups of the influx of weapons and ammunition. And the main emphasis here was on suppressing activity of the Mujahideen in the central provinces, where power was held and the main Soviet units were concentrated. So according to Bibi Gromov, the strategic, who was the commander at the time, strategic revolution at the time boiled down to the fact that the revolutionary government had no right to collapse. In other words, the government had to be maintained at all costs. That was the mission of the Soviet invasion. But prior to the Vail, Operation Vail, from the Pakistani side alone, you had 100 routes going around garrisons and outposts, taking advantage of the difficult terrain. And the Afghan army was not involved in fighting here. They didn't give information, even though they had 24 battalions stationed near the state border with Pakistan. And the only thing that really worked was ambush tactics. But the Afghan army, again, this kind of reminds a little bit of Vietnam. The Afghan army was less than useless in these cases. And it's the fault of the government at the time. So you talk about a zone of responsibility, a border of, 1,000 miles and a depth of maybe 100 miles, assigned the most intense in southern and eastern directions near the Pakistani border. So the Operation Vail had about 11 motorized rifle battalions, but it was a 3 reconnaissance battalion and 60 reconnaissance platoons where the work was done. And the special forces were brought in to ambush the caravan units. And they worked autonomously, caravans as well as the special forces. And as many of you know who studied the Soviet invasion, the attack helicopter was the most successful a weapon that the Soviets had. Their special forces were professionals, and they were trained in anti-guerrilla, anti-insurgent movements. The management of the special forces were carried out by the operational group called Ekran, supplied the brigades with intelligence and coordinated their actions. The Spetsnaz numbers, there were about 4,000. The estimate was that maybe 80,000 men were required to complete the task of closing the border with conventional forces. It was simply impossible. Politically speaking, that was the dedication of that many men in that area was not plausible. But with all this, the 40th Army's Intelligence Department, as well as the Spetsnaz unit, intercepted maybe a fifth of all caravans. Just like in the Vietnam War, they simply adapted to their attacks. Despite the Soviet adaptability here, they simply changed. They know the caravan better than the routes better than the Soviets do. So by 86, there was an extraordinary plenum of the PDPA, the Central Committee of the, again, they never called themselves communists, but they were, of course, were pro-Soviet. They proclaimed a new course. The new course was national reconciliation. And they said at the plenum that national reconciliation is a stage in the development of the National Democratic Revolution, a special kind of political compromise in which the task of establishing a democratic system, ending the war, and accelerating socioeconomic development in a multi-party system, coalition forms of government merge into one indissoluble whole. Complexity and economic life is to be built. That's what they stated. So In January of 87, the Revolutionary Council of the Democratic Republic of Afghanistan adopted this program. And the army and security forces were ordered to cease all offensive operations against the Mujahideen. Now, the opposition leaders, Mujahideen leaders, early in 87, were able to get together, and they decided no compromise. They will intensify hostilities, despite the order to the Afghan army to do no more, engage no more offensive operations. In spring of 87, they carried out what's called acts of intimidation, demonstrative attacks on the border territories of the USSR, artillery and mortar shelling almost hitting the Soviet Union itself, showing the world just how powerful they were, which means Soviet troops had to increase their activities. And they continued to have successful operations. Operation Magistral, which unblocked the Khost Road, which is very important politically. But the government's National Reconciliation Plan had been completely ineffective. They recreated the organizational movement, and nothing lasted. The Afghan party was simply too divided. The armed opposition had no interest in peace and rejected all the proposals of peace that the government sent to them, largely because it was done from a position of weakness. This is what stimulated the leadership of the USSR to intensify efforts for a political solution to the problem and eventual withdrawal of the Soviet troops. And it all comes down not so much to the failure of Soviet arms, but rather the absolute inability of the Afghan party, the PDPA, to function really at all. So, 1988, a letter from the Central Committee of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union was sent to all party organizations explaining the need for the withdrawal of Soviet troops from Afghanistan and the political solution. Again, not that much different from the Vietnam War, except the Soviets never saw themselves as losers here. The Afghan government is what the problem was. The USSR and Afghanistan implemented what, you know, amounted to the Geneva Agreements, and Soviet troops began to prepare for withdrawal. Battles weren't lost, but when you didn't have the cooperation of the Afghan army, I mean, this isn't too different than, of course, the American experience. The Afghan army was just as disastrous, not quite as disastrous as the one that the U.S. had to work with, but it's simply the party's fault. Now, the Soviets realized, you know, Najibullah became the head of the party. In the meantime, Soviets were aware that his death was pretty much guaranteed by the withdrawal of Soviet troops. They were going to withdraw anyway. So what they did was improve the economic position of the government. There was a limited contingent of Soviet troops intensifying to fight against the Mujahideen. There was a rebellion in Kunduz, which was successfully repressed in August of 88. But with the news of the Soviet withdrawal, the gradual withdrawal of men, the Islamic opposition seized more and more territories. Late 88, early 89, Najibullah absolutely bombarded the Soviet leadership with messages, this begging, just desperate messages, to delay the withdrawal of Soviet troops. And you had a division within the Soviet leadership itself. The foreign minister who became president of Georgia, Shevardnadze, supported that, not to delay the withdrawal. The Communist Party and the USSR, in fact an overwhelming majority, favored a complete withdrawal. The last military assistance to Afghanistan was clearing the Salang Pass, captured by the troops of Ahmad Massoud, who was the Mujahideen's most successful leader. And that was it. January of 89, Soviet troops began their last operation in the Salang Pass. For 2 days, 600 Mujahideen and 3 Soviet soldiers were killed. I have the feeling that Western estimates of Soviet casualties are more propaganda than anything else. So the southern Salang area, clear to the formations of Massoud, and then transferred to the government forces, to the Afghan army. February 15th, the last Soviet units left Afghanistan. Now, the withdrawal of Soviet troops did not lead to the immediate collapse of the Soviet regime. They left Najibullah in control of all major cities for 3 more years. As the Soviets withdrew, they still were fighting. And Jalalabad region was cleared of oppositionists even in April of 89. So what Najibullah did as a way to compensate, he transformed himself from a communist leader to a national leader. What's going on in the Soviet Union in 1989 is well known. The end of 88, beginning of 89, the Afghan government controlled 81% of provincial centers. After the withdrawal of the government forces, after the withdrawal of Soviet troops, the DRA controlled most of the country's territory. There was only 2 provinces that were under the Mujahideen control. But even in 1990, the DRA repelled several Mujahideen offensives. But in the future, finding itself completely isolated, the DRA government was unable to cope with the detachments of the Mujahideen. In the first half of 1991, it controlled only 10% of the country's territory. And as some of you know, Najibullah was captured and tortured to death. Now, the question is, does this mean that the Soviet Union was defeated? The United States was absolutely defeated. You had grand total, and I think this is a bit of an exaggeration, but a grand total of 150,000 men at their peak from the 40th Army. The Afghan army was about 60,000 regulars. Most will say that the total number of Soviet dead were 9,500. Grand total of 15,000, but only the combat deaths were 9,500. 53,000 wounded. They lost 451 aircraft, which includes helicopters, and 147 tanks. And this came largely from the introduction of the Stinger missiles, the shoulder-launched missile, wire-guided, that could now bring down a Soviet fighter. 18,000 of the 65,000 Afghan soldiers were killed. But as far as the Mujahideen is concerned, the consensus is maybe 100,000 casualties total. 56,000 killed in combat. But even the Pakistanis had almost 6,000 men killed. So as far as the numbers are concerned, it certainly wasn't a defeat of the Soviet forces. Now, General Gromov, commander of the 40th Army, who, by the way, is head of the Moscow district today, and a member of the Communist Party, he put together 4 myths about the Afghan War, which are worth talking about. He takes exception to naming this the Soviet-Afghan War, because he said it implies that the conflict was bilateral, a confrontation between the USSR and Afghanistan, which isn't the case. This was a concept that was popularized in the West during the Cold War because it gave the Mujahideen a certain level of legitimacy. And he makes it clear, though. He says, and this has actually been a point of controversy, the Soviet Army was legally present in Afghanistan since the USSR was officially invited by the ruling Afghan government in 1979, which is a direct parallel to the deployment of Russian troops in Syria in 2015. So the Afghan conflict was an internal confrontation between the government in power, the PDPA, the People's Democratic Party of Afghanistan, and the more or less the centralized Mujahideen, or Dushmans. So it isn't a black and white clash of the Afghan nation against the Soviet Union. One of the reasons I think that the Soviet casualty figures are a bit exaggerated is you didn't have high-intensity conflict here, except in the very beginning where the Mujahideen were soundly defeated. Everything was done on a small scale. Myth number two is the most direct, that the Soviet Union lost the Afghan war, and it cemented Afghanistan's moniker of the cemetery of empires, the graveyard of empires. And Glomov, again, not the most objective source, but someone who was there on the ground, he makes it clear that win or lose wasn't really the issue. We've mentioned this already. He never received orders to win in Afghanistan. At its peak, again, this shows you that the consensus figure is wrong, the 40th Army numbered 108,800 men, which is certainly insufficient for any kind of a full victory and occupation of a country that size. In Vietnam, the U.S. deployed a contingent of troops five times larger than that, in an area about five times smaller than Afghanistan. Gromov's orders were that the mission of the 40th Army and the DRA was to ensure favorable conditions for the activities of the legitimate government of the PDPA. So on December 25th, 79, you had a limited contingent of Soviet troops introduced into the country, which had been in this country for almost 10 years prior. So it was a reinforcement of Soviet military specialists already in the country rather than a direct invasion. Natalia Khanova on Radio Sputnik a few years ago gave her assessment. It's not a bad assessment here. She said, "Those who view the outcome of the campaign through the prism of victory-defeat do not understand the complex nature of military operations against partisans. I am convinced that Soviet soldiers successfully completed their mission in Afghanistan. It was the party itself that lost." Lomov says, "Soviet troops controlled the overwhelming majority of the territory of Afghanistan through the campaign. Not a single outpost was captured by the Mujahideen, despite the growing funding from outside the country." That Najibullah, despite his ultimate failure, successfully created effective security institutions. And his popularity did grow thanks to the policy of national reconciliation, despite its ultimate failure. Glomov says, "At the time of our exit, the government was able to autonomously maintain order in the DRA, provided that financial and economic support from the USSR continued." And the obvious point, people like Glomov were asked, well, what happened? Why was the government of Najibullah ultimately overthrown? He said that the Soviet Union collapsed. The foreign policy of the new Russian leadership completely rejected any support for Najibullah or any interest in Afghanistan at all. The Mujahideen, even according to the CIA, could never have overthrown the PDPA government if the Soviet Union continued to provide financial assistance. So two things occurred. The PDPA, even under Najibullah, who was probably more competent than previous leaders we mentioned, was too divided, and there was too much bad blood for them to function competently, although Najibullah did try to fix that. National reconciliation policy was not a success, but it did have positive outcomes. And the Soviet Union collapsing. These are the two variables that led to the perception of a Soviet defeat. And even during the war itself, and Isogromov makes a certain, wants to emphasize that, that during the war itself, the USSR implemented numerous civil, economic, and political programs aimed at raising the standard of living for the local population. In 1982 alone, he says, the 40th Army conducted 127 civilian operations that included renovating houses, building roads, distributing food and medicine to local residents, and holding cultural events. And that's the Army itself, let alone what the civilian specialists were doing in the country. You had economic advisors, and it's a little bit ironic that you had economic specialists at a time when the Soviet Union was completely collapsing under its own weight. But there was no use of scorched earth tactics or anything like that. That unlike the American adventure, the Soviets realized any kind of counterinsurgency operation has to be based on good relations with the local population. It's vital to the success of any kind of public policy action and the reduction of casualties, which for the Army is the top priority. They even forged relations with their opponents, such as the late Ahmad Shah Massoud. And a deal was made with him so that he can say they could safely pull the Soviet troops out. It was not a defeat from that point of view. Gromov was asked to compare the Soviet presence in Afghanistan to the American. And he said this. I mean, by the way, the U.S. was there 17 years, the Soviets not quite 10. He said, during our deployment to the DRA, the 40th Army controlled most of the territory of Afghanistan, forcing the Mujahideen to operate from underground, so they did not have real power in the country. Now, of course, that was never the case with the American invasion. The Americans were not invited. They were there on completely make-believe intelligence. It had nothing to do with 9/11 or anything else. But even at their best, the Taliban, who are not the old Mujahideen, they'd be too old, maybe they were commanded by them, but not the same group of people, operated even at their worst at 70% of Afghanistan. The U.S. controlled a few cities. And Gromov says, unlike the Americans, who tend to sit in their bases, Soviet soldiers were deployed throughout the country, both in large cities and in small villages and settlements. This made it possible to more effectively control the territory and improve relations with the population. Now, Gromov also says that unlike the United States, the Soviet Union did not seek to impose its political and economic system on Afghanistan. Its presence in the country was primarily, quote, driven by pragmatic geopolitical interests, especially security, not ideology. Then he says, in reality, the 40th Army made significant progress in Afghanistan, fulfilling its goals, and this would have continued had it not been for the larger geopolitical changes. In particular, the collapse of the USSR. Now, given the fact that he was a commander of the 40th Army and directly implicated with anything that happened there, of course his testimony is going to be colored a little bit. He was given the highest award, the Hero of the Soviet Union, for his service there. Then, of course, as I said, he became governor of the Moscow region and created the Combat Brotherhood, which is the largest veteran organization in the country. And he was on the Communist Party bill. But whether or not the Soviets were defeated is a strange question. Once the Soviets withdrew, the Western press, the Chinese press, Western European press, and of course the Mujahideen themselves, talked about this huge victory. Some Western politicians went so far as to argue that the defeat of the Soviet troops in Afghanistan contributed to the collapse of the Soviet Union itself, which was, you know, bin Laden and al-Qaeda also made that statement, that they destroyed a superpower. They destroyed one superpower and in the process of destroying another one. But the Mujahideen did not defeat the Soviet troops in the battlefield. Now, their only real victory was the Battle of the Panjshir Gorge, but they lost everything else. You really can't speak of victory in this sense. I think Gromov is right in this regard. Gorbachev, of course, was the architect of the withdrawal, and he said that they had reached an impasse, no longer justified its high costs in terms of human losses and financial costs, and the international prestige of the Soviet Union was harmed. But without considering this, American officials came to the conclusion that the Soviet armed forces were inferior. And even Morton Abramovich, who was the State Department head of the State Department's Bureau on Intelligence and Research, he said in 1985, we're really worried that the Mujahideen were losing, that their numbers were decreasing, and that the units were breaking up. Losses were high. The damage they inflicted on Soviet troops was relatively small. So you absolutely had a consensus in the U.S., and they kept it under wraps, that the Soviets were winning. You could never say that about the U.S. in Vietnam, although, of course, there are some theories that say that that's the case. So, to summarize here, even though Gromov doesn't like it, we call it the Soviet-Afghan War, was a battle between the Mujahideen, and there were, by the way, a handful of Maoist groups connected with China, fought a 9-year guerrilla war against the DRA and, of course, the 40th Army, mostly in the Afghan countryside. Estimates of the total number of deaths are between 600,000 and 3 million. And it's strange how this war didn't lead to the massive invasion of Europe like other wars in the area have done. It was very strange. But it did have millions of refugees. Weren't directed to Europe, though, but they were taken to Pakistan and Iran. About 10% of the population were killed. I don't believe that it led to the dissolution of the Soviet Union, but it was caused by the Sour Revolution, where the Communist Party took over and engaged in extreme, the communists would call modernization reforms. Very unpopular in the traditional Muslim world and the rural population. The Democratic Republic was so not subtle, put it that way, in its implementation of this, that it created a violent response by the opposition. They were taking political prisoners and executing them. They were destroying each other. As I mentioned, the division between the Clarkists and the Partamites, and the murder of Nur Muhammad Taraki on orders of Hizbullah Amin. All of this showed that the party itself was the problem, not the Soviet invasion. And there was a fear that Amin was going to go to the U.S., and he was connected with the CIA. It was a reluctant move of Brezhnev to send the 40th Army across the border in 1979. They killed Amin and installed Babrak Kamal from the Partam faction. But whatever faction was in power, they ended up trying to destroy the other faction. The casualty rates were fairly low for a 9-year war, but the international prestige of the Soviet Union was harmed, largely because of the Western press. India did support the Soviet invasion, but the CIA played a huge role. This is from the National Security Archive. The Central Intelligence Agency played a significant role in asserting U.S. influence in Afghanistan by funding military operations designed to frustrate the Soviet invasion of the country. CIA covert action worked through Pakistani intelligence services to reach Afghan rebel groups. So, of course, Gromov says that the Soviets, the Afghan government was in almost total control of the country. But that was challenged by the U.S. at the time. So, as they were building irrigation plants, as they were building power plants, they were then destroying other parts of the country. It was a wash as far as that's concerned. Those roads were long since dug up, and a lot of those plants were long gone. Now, Gromov, though, is generally correct. They had no intention of occupying the country. Their mission was very specific. The intervention of the 40th Army meant that the communist government of Afghanistan could function without having to worry about constant attacks from the Mujahideen. It was meant to only be a few years, and by then they'd have created an economic structure that would keep them in power. Unfortunately, that structure was built by the USSR, eventually destroyed in later years, but more importantly, the PDPA was simply an impossible ally. All they did was attack each other, and they would use the army for this, which destroyed morale that was already extremely low. Like the Ho Chi Minh Trail and other roads going through Cambodia and the Vietnam War, the cross-border caravan routes were impossible to stop. I don't think anyone denies that the Soviet Army had adapted themselves very successfully to this guerrilla war. But the point was to inflict enough damage on the Mujahideen so that the government can build itself. And, of course, that was the ultimate failure. The CIA, as I've already mentioned, stated that if the Soviet Union had continued, there would have been no victory of the Mujahideen at all. That was simply impossible. They were building an infrastructure worth defending. The army was recovering. But since this government was dependent on the USSR, like a lot of Afghan governments were, when the Soviet Union fell apart, it fell apart. And it lasted about as long as the South Vietnamese government lasted. As some of you know, I've been a defender of the South Vietnamese government for some time in that war. But the incompetence of the Afghan government was far worse. The rotation of dictators and leaders in South Vietnam was a problem, but that wasn't the case in Afghanistan. Their case was extremely ingrained incompetence and corruption. That was what defeated the mission. The mission wasn't to win in any sense. It was to build the Afghan party's movement. Unfortunately, the party was so ham-handed in how it handled reform in the countryside that they created more enemies than anything else. That was changing by 1990. I'm not sure that the Soviets lost in any meaningful sense. And the parallels with the American operation there are very few. Anyway, thank you everyone for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.